Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
Okay, today, I don't know, they're all unusual shows, I guess. This is an unusual show in the sense that we're going to focus on two titans of comedy. We're going to spend a larger portion of the time talking about Robin Williams, and then towards the end of the show, add a conversation about George Carlin. A lot of odd things have happened in coincidence with all this. I guess we'll talk about them as we go along. The trigger for all this is David Skoff's splendid biography of Robin Williams. It's called Robin. It's a really interesting book, too. It has more than most biographies. I think it has a kind of spring, summer, fall, winter cycle to it. I mean, I guess all of our lives are springs, summers, falls, and then winters, but this one, I think, has that very, very acutely. We thought in order to have a comedian talk also about Robin Williams, it would make sense to have Carolyn Payne, a frequent guest on the show, actress, comedian, dancer, founder, director, choreographer of Kinetic Dance. If I didn't say so already, David Skoff is also a culture reporter for the New York Times. A little bit later, we'll introduce our George Carlin-related guests. I think maybe the best thing to do before we even start talking to Dave is just to kind of refresh your mind about Robin Williams. I was just stumbling around today looking at various things on the interwebs. I came across one of his appearances with Craig Ferguson. And I think it sort of illustrates some very specific things about Robin Williams. So, Betsy, let's just play that clip.
When did you get married?
What day is it?
Pretty recently.
After a honeymoon, I'm a little low on protein.
I hear you. Did you have to go all the way to protein? Well, yeah. Couldn't you just have a little tired of protein? You had to go to protein.
I'm a little tired. I'm running low on fluid.
When you hit 60, everything. And what have we got left? Yeah. Give me some mucus, anything. We ran out of sperm. Let's go, people.
I like it when you're here, I can relax.
You know, it's a bit like a Tourettian hotline.
Is there a positive Tourette's? I know sometimes the negative Tourette's are like, people say things like,
yeah.
But is there a positive Tourette's where someone goes like, those pants are slimming?
Do you think that, when Thanksgiving's coming up, do you think that's the rapture for turkeys? That every year they go, get ready.
Some of us are leaving.
And then the ones who don't get taken up are like, ah!
Well, they're like that anyway, so yeah, it's all right.
All right. Another thing about that particular interview is that an awful lot of it, Robin Williams is, perhaps unsurprisingly, talking back to Craig Ferguson in essentially Craig Ferguson's accent. So David Skoff, this is latter day Robin Williams. And in an odd way, it still resembles early day Robin Williams. In that sense, anyway, that sense that we get, which you kind of expose as somewhat illusion in your book, in that sense of this person who's just always on, always operating, you know, at 110%.
Well, you can tell from that clip that, yeah, he still had a lot of vitality. And also, I think he was very much turned on by other people who were also spontaneous in the way that he was. Craig Ferguson was a great kind of foil to him in those appearances, that it was it's a little bit like a prize fighter coming back into the ring, and he has to prove himself. He has to show that I'm just as funny and just as off the cuff as Ferguson. And you can hear, again, even in that conversation, there are moments that are, I think, genuinely ad-libbed, and then a couple that are probably lines that he had in his back pocket just kind of ready to deploy that sound off the cuff. But you're right. That was not who he was 24 hours a day. That was really just for the benefit of the cameras and, I think, for the studio audience that could react to what he was doing.
So speaking of him not being that 24 hours a day, I just want to also say that one of the things that Williams could do, and actually, Carolyn, I think you would confirm this too, is I mean, listen to him. He goes from this conversation that's kind of going on inside his body, where there's some like office manager demanding more fluids be directed to this cause of honeymoon sex, to positive Tourette's, to turkeys. And, you know, he's not really even setting up jokes the way a comedian typically would, right? He does it a little bit, but he almost, there's no sense of timing. He's just going to go there and you're going to run after him.
Yeah, it's just a rapid fire. And I think that that's something that you can't even imitate. It's a quality that he had that is so unique, where he could just live in this stream of consciousness and just spew these things out. And sometimes as a comedian, you throw something out there and it just isn't landing and you need that buildup or you need to rework it. But it felt like Robin Williams just had this spontaneous ability to just kind of always hit bullseye.
Right.
He would, you know, curate this stuff and create it. And it just kind of like lived inside of him. But it was so amazing how he could just spew these like wild. It was like a fireworks show, like the grand finale of a fireworks show was Robin Williams just constantly in performance.
Right. And when you're moving that fast, if something doesn't land, you just keep going. Anyway, so Dave, one of the questions then becomes, you know, where are the other Robin Williamses? And so your book, near the conclusion of your book, this is rather tender little story about you and Robin Williams going comic book shopping. I'll let you just say a little bit of it. I don't want to wreck the whole story for people who haven't read the book, but you know, we do see somebody else there. Yeah.
Yeah, you're not spoiling anything. It was in the midst of working on a profile of him for the New York Times, and in one of our interviews, I'd happened to mention to him, we were just talking about comic books in general, which we were both fans of, and I mentioned a store that I shopped at in New York, and he said, "Oh, that's where I go when I'm in New York, and maybe you know the next time I'm in town, I'll take you there." And I didn't think it was anything that he genuinely intended to do, but then a few months later, I did get a call from him when he was in New York, inviting me to meet him there, and it was pretty fascinating just to be in his presence, in public. He didn't have any like security around him. He didn't have an assistant or a handler. It was just him, you know, with no barrier between him and the people who were also at this store. And people really were in sort of genuine amazement. And this is still in 2009. So again, late in his career, it wasn't peak Robin Williams, but he was one of those people who was just so famous and that people were so just dazzled by the notion that he was a kind of live human being that you could interact with and see in your day-to-day existence really kind of flummoxed people.
You know, the one time that I ever was in the presence of Robin Williams was on the set of The World According to Garp, and a bunch of journalists had been kind of ushered onto the set. It was the scenes that were being filmed on an island out in the middle of Long Island Sound. And you know, I mean, we were just offered a chance to come see the set, and I'd loved the book, and I just had interviewed Glenn Close for something else, and I thought, well, this will be great. And Robin Williams is like essentially there to greet the boat as it lands, and he just started. He felt under some obligation. Here he is, you know, in his first major film role, you know, and he's already a pretty big star from Mork and Mindy. He felt under some obligation to entertain this bunch of journalists that he didn't know from Adam, and you know, who were going to be there for a very short time, and he's just started to do material, and somebody would throw something out at him, a little line, and he'd riff off of it. And I remember he did a whole Jack Daniels thing, which I guess is maybe a little closer to the bone than I had realized, but
That's pretty hilarious. Yeah,
but
I mean, it's very consistent.
Yeah.
I think. I mean, it speaks to both that I think that the desire of his, if there were, you know, any group of people, and a group of people could be two people, that on the one hand he has that compulsion to want to entertain them, but also I think a need to kind of please people, that's something that he felt sort of obliged to do, and that there's also a little bit of self-protection in that, that if he's performing or if he's in character, he's also kind of keeping his authentic self a little bit at a distance from you, and it's keeping him safe from judgment.
So, yeah, Dave, reading the book, I return to that question all the time.
Yeah.
You know, that question of is there, I mean, the book ends, we should say, I think one of the last scenes in the book is this whole idea that before a concert performance, he was alone behind a door for 45 minutes. Nobody was allowed to disturb him or talk to him or bother him, and nobody really knew what he was doing in there, but he had to have that time. And you use it as kind of a metaphor. But I do feel as though this is a guy who was sidestepping fundamental questions about himself, you know? And so you, for example, quote the fact that he would say, you know, this may disappoint everybody, but I had a happy childhood. And then you explore his childhood. And, you know, it doesn't really seem that happy to me. And you describe his parents as these two people who were kind of into each other in a way that often didn't make room for him. They'd go on these long trips, you know, and leave him alone with the help in this big mansion. I don't know. It sounded like ultimately he was a little uncomfortable telling the truth about something as basic as that.
Yeah, I think that it becomes a hugely important and influential dynamic in his life, that those formative years, as you mentioned, you know, his family was actually quite wealthy. And we think of comedians often as coming, maybe we'll talk more about this with Carlin as well, coming from backgrounds of some adversity or hardship. And certainly that was not Robin's life at all, that his father was a very successful executive at Ford, and the family had to move a bit between Illinois and Michigan, depending on where the company needed him at the time. And so they're living in these, you know, massive houses that with way more space than they need. His father is traveling quite a bit. His mother also was very social and, you know, into social functions, organizing parties, and into his father and traveling a lot with him. Both were on their second marriage. Each had a child from a previous marriage who were not raised with Robin. So he grew up for a few years sort of believing himself to be an only child. And then when he was around 8 or 10, learned about these two other half-brothers. So, you know, the sense of, I think, you know, in some way not getting the affirmation that he felt he needed or wanted. And also a lot of the solitude that was time for him to kind of develop his skills that he'd use as a stand-up and a performer. But that loneliness definitely lingered with him through the rest of his life.
And Carolyn, if there's one theme that probably runs through the lives of people who are performatively funny, whether they're comedians or some other kind of version of that, is I think you learn early on that you can get some attention that way, right?
Yeah. I think my parents would tell you, like, that was definitely an indication that I was going to be a performer, was that, yeah, I mean, it is. And a lot of times, like, so for someone like Robin Williams, that like sense of loneliness that you're talking about that he may have had as a child, and I think for me, thinking of that with him, it kind of makes sense that he would create all these characters and these voices that he could do kind of to keep himself company. And I know that sometimes, like, for me, that need for attention, like, I find, like, I want to use performing to get attention, but in real life, I don't want attention.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I dread
vouch for this.
Yeah, I dread having to have a conversation like at a grocery store or anywhere. Literally, like Grubhub is the best thing because I don't have to talk to anyone, and anything where I don't have to talk to someone. So, and I think it's interesting that despite being like that, I am super eager to grab attention on a stage or in any sort of performing venue or any sort of place where I can kind of be outside who you actually are and kind of hide behind that.
So, David Scott, the one thing that ties all this together. Well, go ahead. You're about to react to her, so go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think it's interesting because you know, just as you're sort of, you know, talking about yourself. I mean, there are, you know, stories that people told me. I mean, people who were very important in Robin's life, whether it was his first wife, Valerie Velarde, or Pam Dauber, who of course was his co-star on Mork and Mindy. When each of them were first introduced to him, he basically put on a character for them. That with Valerie, they met at a bar. He pretended to be a Frenchman the whole night. You know, with Pam Dauber, they meet at their first publicity photo shoot for Mork and Mindy, and Robin pretends to be a Russian man. And again, it's this act of, on the one hand, wanting to, you know, entertain the other person or make them feel comfortable, but it's also, on his part, a little bit of guarding himself, that if he shows if he shows his true self to these people right away and they were to reject him somehow, then that would be incredibly hurtful to him. And so it's, you know, comedy as a sort of an act of self-protection.
Right. I mean, there's a way in which the mask becomes comfortable. His idol, Jonathan Winter, yeah. Winters would have trouble even getting out of his Maude Frickert character occasionally because, I mean, he was like, mentally ill at that point. But yeah, I mean, the story that you tell in the book, just to once again emphasize it a little bit, he meets Valerie, and she's from New Haven. We should point that out. He meets Valerie, and he spends the whole night talking to her in a French accent. She does not know that he's not French. She thinks she's talking to some French guy. I mean, he just doesn't drop it, right?
Yeah, no, and I mean this is the night that they're both going to look back on as essentially their first date, and he's not even really himself. You know, she's totally taken by him, but she's not really seeing the real man, and she's not going to totally get to know that person for a little while. And
it's like he almost catfished her.
Before there was such a thing.
See, he's so innovative. Yeah.
So. So this is another. This is kind of a sad thing. First of all, we should say that when David Bowie died, Dave was nice enough to come on our show, and I tried to get Caroline on the show, but I was the one telling her that David Bowie had died, so that just wasn't a good thing. So now I have to be the person to tell her that Coco the gorilla has died, and so we'll circle back to you in a second, Caroline. But you know, of everything that I looked at to get ready for this, Dave, watching the clip of Williams and Coco the gorilla was so interesting to me because I felt like looking at his face, I was seeing something, you know, some little fragment of all that stuff that he really wasn't. I mean, you can't pretend with animals. You can't impress a gorilla with how verbally funny you are or how good your accents are, right? And so he's, I don't know, there was something very interesting going on there.
Yeah, I think that's a sign of real empathy, don't you think? That if you can connect just with another living creature in that way, it has to be on a kind of a heart level or a soul level, because you're right that all of our kind of verbal higher level communication is useless in those scenarios. And I think it really does sort of show you, Robin's ability, in particular, to sort of reach out in that way, that whatever he was dealing with, it was always, always an attempt to understand that other person or being in some way.
Okay, now you can do your thing. Is it like comedians like Coco or something?
Colin just shook my world, telling me right when I got here that he burst out with Coco the gorilla died, and I had to have a moment. I grew up loving Coco. There was that book that came out, where she had the kittens.
All Ball.
The kitten, yeah. And, I remember seeing that video of Robin interacting with Coco. And Robin Williams, one of the things about him that I think is true with a lot of comedians, and maybe it's that need for attention in some ways, it has this childlike quality. And that was something that really like came out when you saw him interacting with Coco. There, it was like this very pure, playful moment that just was, you know, exactly like shield down or shield up rather, and just kind of it was very sweet. And Coco, I mean, had a lot of those interactions, like the one with Mr. Rogers and Betty White, where you just saw. And I'm just shook by this Coco news today.
But, so, well, one of the ways, this may be a forced segue, but one of the things that comes out in your book, Dave, that may suggest some kind of a relationship to Coco is that Robin Williams was, as we, I guess, know from Fisher King and other places, really hairy and smelled kind of bad.
Well, I mean, he certainly had a bohemian period. I think that, the transition from growing up in the Midwest to basically arriving in Marin County, California in 1969 and the tail end of the Summer of Love and into an extremely liberal community. And that's basically, the mindset that he took into college and to Juilliard, where he was very regarded as, a very, bohemian figure and somebody who didn't necessarily feel the need for basic hygienic rituals and that sort of thing. But yes, the hairiness was something that was part of him from very early on, and that certainly was a sort of a prime requisite of his for most of his life. Yes.
Right. And Bill, you describe a Depardieu-like earthiness. I mean, I think Pam Dopper says that he would sit on her and fart on her.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they had a pretty, you know, unusual relationship in that way. They were both about the same age. They had both come, lived parts of their life in Michigan, and they really had almost a kind of a sibling-like, interaction that they both, really connected with each other in that way. And I think in some ways tried to look out for each other, but also I think, Dauber understood very clearly that Mork and Mindy was Robin's vehicle. She was essentially the in their double act, the straight woman, and there to react to his jokes and to be a kind of the grounding force. He was the one who was allowed to kind of take off and go nuts, and that was something that I think she had to kind of get used to, especially in that first season of the show.
So, Carolyn, we know, and reading Dave's book, he's married to three very beautiful women and had kind of an interest in other women at certain times. And this is a part of him that you don't really entirely relate to.
Yeah, Robin Williams as a sex symbol is not something I really get. I think that he, being a comic is a lot like being a rock star. You're up on stage in front of thousands, maybe millions of people, and there's like this like power and appeal that can come with that. So it's not, it's not hard to understand how like he would have had no trouble finding sex whenever he wanted it. I mean, personally, like
you would not be one of those solutions.
I'd be all set. Yeah, he's just a little too sweaty and hairy for me. But, but there's also, there's like an intellectual aspect. Like, and the idea, he just was such a brilliant man and so funny. Like, there's kind of that intellectual attraction that probably factored into this as well. And it certainly sounds like that with his relationship with Pam.
Yeah. Never boring anyway.
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to talk more with Dave about his book. I want to get into the Robin Williams movie career. We'll grab a quick break and we'll talk after that.
I am what I am, what I am, and I am what I am. And that's all that I am, because I am what I am. You got it?
I think so, yeah.
And I've got a lot of muscle, and I only got one eye, and I never hurt nobody's, and I'll never tell a lie. Top to me bottom, from the bottom to me top.
Hey, Alexander Higgs, House of Missiles, come on down. Let me show you someone. We got this lovely ICBM here. They can't hear you coming. Boom, they blow the f*** off the world. Look at this over here. We got a designer cruise missile. Ooh la la, va boom. Look at that there. Look at this one over here. What is a cruise missile? What is a cruise missile? The missile goes, oh, look, a city, let's destroy it. Every time I do that, I feel like Richard Simmons. Let's go, girls, let's go. 5, 6, 7, and move it, move it, move it, move it. The man is so cruel to women, and they love it. He goes, you call those f***s. I've seen better lumps than oatmeal. Put them together, honey, make one good one. Let's go. Those are not calves, those are steers. Let's move it. You may have had an hourglass figure, but your time is up. Let's go. Let's move now, let's go. The man has a house with nothing but closets, so he can go, I'm in, I'm out, I'm in. Strange. People over here are going, what the hell's he doing now? Catch up.
From An Evening with Robin Williams, we're talking about him today with Dave Itzkoff, a cultural reporter for The New York Times and the author of Robin, a fascinating biography of this man, Carolyn Payne, a comedian, among many other things, also in the studio with me. That little clip reminds me of something that I said to Jonathan, the producer, before I went on the air today, which is you watch some of his old stuff and you realize he couldn't do some of this stuff now. You can't just be funny pretending to be gay or pretending to be black or just having an Indian accent, or there's like a whole lot of things that tripwires that he would kick now that would kind of go off in his face a little bit. I'm sure he'd find something else to do. Dave, I have to talk. There's one thing that you bring up in the book, and I was so happy you did it because it was when I just absolutely decided that this guy was a genius, and we couldn't find the clip today, and I'm not sure it would work on the radio. But pretty early in his career, he did a thing where he talked about, he said, this is what it's like when a comedian bites the big one. And on stage, he simulated bombing as a comedian, where he would throw to himself in this kind of simulated control room, running around, flipping switches, trying to access material. There's this Peter Lorre voice that's kind of chewing him out for doing pee-pee caca. It is just the most remarkably meta, self-doubting thing I've ever seen a comedian do, and no other person could possibly do it.
Yeah, I think it sort of recalls, I think, one of the other bits of his that you played at the beginning, where he is, you know, imagining, he's sort of splitting his consciousness into different parts and playing all of them sort of in real time. But as you say, in reaction to a joke of his failing. And even though it is essentially a humorous routine, it is certainly grounded in a reality for him, which is a fear of failure and a fear of rejection and all the different parts of him that are activated when that would occur on stage, which didn't happen all that often, but it certainly befell him at the start of his career. And the routine certainly shows you the extent to which he did or had thought about how it felt to be rejected by an audience and how much that wounded him. And that would certainly across his film career, where you had very sort of tangible indicators of whether you were succeeding or failing. You had box office results, you had movie reviews, you had award nominations and victories that told you pretty quickly if you were doing the right thing or not. And those were things he took very much to heart over the course of his career.
Right. There's one point that you make in the book that I think is really important. I mean, it's actually a bunch of different points, and that is everything that we just heard in both of the Ferguson clip and that one, these melanges of comedy. There's a lot of things in there besides just the illusion he's projecting that he can just go like this, you know? And you know, there is, for example, a lot of it is a little bit more planned out. You describe the way in which he and his publicist kind of circulated the idea, promoted the idea that a lot of what he did on Mork and Mindy was completely improvised, that he would be given just pages of blank space to work in. That wasn't true, and sometimes his improvisations bombed and he had to go to the material that had been written for him, which actually worked better. There's also, of course, this longstanding thing that other comedians were very distrustful of him because he might steal their material or just repurpose it for his own use. And Billy Crystal, one of his closest friends, says a really interesting thing, which is it's not the material a lot of the times. It isn't that the joke is so great that he's saying. It's that he's doing it in just it's the difference between Bill Russell and Michael Jordan, you know? They're both great, but Michael Jordan is moving a lot faster than Bill Russell ever could.
Yeah, it's interesting because, one of the first places that he and Billy Crystal crossed paths was in 1978 at this benefit concert for, a venue in San Francisco that was, kind of at risk of shutting down, the boarding house where they'd both. It was really more of a rock venue, but they'd both played there as comedians. And so, at that point, they had the same managers and they weren't yet friends. They were kind of, sniffing each other out a little bit to see, well, is this person going to be a rival of mine? Is he going to take work away from me? And Billy at that point he'd already finished his first season on Soap and was about to start season two. He knew that Robin was about to do his first season on Mork and Mindy. And Billy was very openly, or at least in retrospect, envious of Robin because on Soap, even though Billy was playing this kind of renowned character, one of the first openly gay characters on episodic TV, that was the only character he could play on that show, whereas he knew that Robin going into Mork and Mindy could basically use that as a vehicle to play whoever he wanted and do whatever he wanted within the very sort of generous boundaries of that character. And it was something that he was openly jealous of.
So there's this Robin Williams, the Robin Williams we've been hearing and talking about here. There's also an actor, a Juilliard-trained actor, who in the early stages, I think, really toggles between those two things. And some of the acting teachers that you talked to, Dave, were a little distrustful of him. One of them says something like, he never really had a foundation for his acting.
Even by the time he got to Juilliard, he had put in a few years. He went for 3 years to the College of Marin, which is actually a 2-year school in Northern California. But he had focused primarily on acting there and been in a lot of stage productions. You can literally read newspaper reviews of him playing Fagin in Oliver or Snoopy in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, getting great notices there. So by the time he came to Juilliard, they knew he was very talented. But he also, they felt, and this will not surprise you, that he wasn't very disciplined and that, you know, he kind of chafed at the idea of structure. And even while he was at Juilliard, he was still slipping out to do mime performances on the street and other kinds of acting. And not that the mime upset the Juilliard faculty, but just the idea that they couldn't totally regulate this guy, that, you know, he was in student productions there. He got along well. He was well regarded. But ultimately, he withdrew from the school as a kind of mutual decision. He didn't finish his training there, in part because he couldn't get with the program.
I mean, Carlin, this is an interesting thing to watch, too, right? I mean, and it's, you know, anybody who's funny and who, once again, you know, when you're young, you discover you can get some attention if you crave attention from your parents or whoever by being funny. It's a whole different equation when you're doing acting. You've done some acting in comedic series and stuff like that. I'm not sure if you've ever done, like, Maggie and Tennessee Williams or anything like that.
I've done some Shakespeare and things like that. And I did some Molière. That's comedy,
that's right,
I guess. But yeah. You know, but I think that, you know, acting and comedy are two very different things, but there is often a crossover. Like, you see a lot of comedians crossover into acting, and you see some actors, you know, attempt stand-up comedy to try to help themselves with like improv skills and things like that. But I think acting is a much more, it's a discipline thing, and you're working with others. And I think that that's where Robin Williams, like, as an actor, I mean, he would have been fascinating to work with, because I feel like you would have never gotten the same thing twice from him. I think it would have kept, it would have really just been you have to stay on your toes to keep up with him and run as fast as you can, because he's still going to outrun you in everything you do.
Well, Dave, I jumped ahead in your book to the section about Fisher King, because when...
That's okay.
If people ask me, well, I mean, I went back to, but when people ask me what my favorite movie is, I'm as likely to say Fisher King as any other movie. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you, I mean, to Carolyn's point, you know, is Jeff Bridges came aboard on this movie had two male leads to it. Jeff Bridges plays this incredibly jaded and destructive shock jock who unintentionally causes the death of a whole group of people. And Robin Williams plays this guy who's basically a crazy person, more or less living on the streets, in the grip of this kind of fusion of Robin Hood and Arthurian romance. And you say that Bridges showed up thinking, well, he's going to be wacky funny. You know, I'm ready for that. And really kind of found a slightly different person there.
Yeah, I mean, it's so fascinating because, first of all, the role that Bridges is playing is a little bit against type for him, that he's the much more kind of buttoned-up character, he's almost this kind of gloss on Howard Stern or Don Imus, not the most likable, warm guy. And you know, he had not worked with Robin to that point and knew him only by reputation. And you know, Robin's film career was really in a groove at that point, that he had done certainly Good Morning Vietnam, which was a huge breakout for him. He had done Dead Poets Society, which was a more subdued character, but also Robin had this reputation for being just this electric comedian, and certainly for wanting to improvise a lot, not only on stage, but in his film roles. And so that's the kind of person that you know, Bridges was expecting. And he talked about a scene that he has to film where, you know, basically, you know, he's in a coma, you know, the character is, and just basically having to talk to him while he's in a coma so he can't react, and not knowing how Robin is going to play that scene, and actually finding him to be very tender and very attuned to it, and not trying to turn it into a joke or a bit, but taking it very seriously. And I mean, Terry Gilliam, as you saw in the book, I mean, told some pretty intense stories from that movie about how seriously Robin took it and how much he got into that character of Parry.
Right. At one point, Williams is pushing himself kind of physically in addition to everything else.
Yeah.
And finally, Gilliam says, this isn't good for you. I mean, he just makes him just stop and take it down. You know, so I think, Carolyn, you can kind of divide the Williams career between some of these roles where he really mutes everything that we know about him. And as he moves along as an actor, is able to submerge himself into these roles. So whether it's Good Will Hunting or Awakenings or Fisher King, he's able to kind of quiet down some of that, you know, just incredibly virtuoso comedy stuff that he can do. And then there are other roles that just let him do that, whether it's Good Morning Vietnam or I think maybe your favorite
Aladdin.
Yeah.
I mean, Aladdin is where his performance as the genie in Aladdin, I think, is brilliant because you're not seeing his face, but literally could not have been any other actor. And I think as far as like voiceover work goes, I think that that is one of the best voiceover work performances that I can think of. And I recently rewatched Aladdin. It was like on TV and I hadn't seen it since I was a kid. And it's still just so, I think even more so, I had even more respect for how he utilizes the incredible instrument he had of this like voice to create these characters and these nuances and everything. So I think that's, to me, that is still one of Robin Williams' best performances.
I think
I mean, if you just listen to it as a performance, it's actually, I mean, he's going into a million voices and characters and bits, but it's also, you can hear how relaxed he is, that there is something about, being given the freedom to just go wild. Don't worry about sort of putting the brakes on yourself or having to rein yourself in, that I think it is actually very comfortable for him. And you can really hear it in his delivery.
I
said we're going to need to wrap this up so we can move on to George Carlin. But Dave, I said that your book, and it really is a wonderful book. I'm not just saying this, but it has this kind of, even more than most life stories, it really does have this spring, summer, fall, winter quality to it. And the winter is a very harsh winter. And so the death, which you go through, is, it's almost like there's four or five deaths that are digested by the public and people around him slowly. Suicide, Parkinson's, depression, ultimately Lewy body problems, which are sort of, a condition that's not Alzheimer's, but probably resembles Alzheimer's more than anything else. His final act was, once again, this very complicated, layered set of questions.
Yeah, I think, it's understandable in a sense that, there wasn't a lot of information in the immediate aftermath of his death because it was so shocking not only to the wider world, but certainly to his family and the people that knew him intimately. And it was difficult for them, I think, to try to determine how they should communicate this to people. And it's not an easy thing. And so, there was a period of about a week where there was just a kind of total vacuum. And so people, made just based on whatever, little information that was out, made sort of certain assumptions about, why he'd taken his life. And people kind of focused on, was he depressed or disappointed about his career? And, none of which, again, I understand why people made those kinds of assumptions, but it wasn't valid. It wasn't based in what had happened. And then about a week later, his widow put out a statement, and this was true that in Robin's own lifetime, he had been given a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. And so I think that may have sort of furthered the assumption that it was a deliberate choice on his part. So it was not until many months after his death when his autopsy was released, and part of which was, they analyzed samples of his brain tissue and found evidence of Lewy body disease or Lewy body dementia, which is, a degenerative condition of the brain. It is similar to Parkinson's, but it's not just attacking the motor part of the brain. It's parts of the brain that involve, cognition and reasoning and decision making. And so, what he was experiencing was quite terrible in the sense that people who have this can have paranoia, mood swings. They can kind of, some people have hallucinations. They may shut down in their own body. You can't really even say with certainty that when he died, he knew exactly what he was doing, or if he sort of understood, was he aware of who he was and what he was doing at the time? It's really hard to say.
Right. So reading your book and reading more about Lewy body than I had previously known, it struck me that some of those really hallucinatory episodes that Perry, his character in Fisher King, has probably may have resembled some of the realities of the end of his life. We're going to end this conversation about Robin Williams on a happier note. We're going to end it in a way that will make Carolyn Payne happy, especially, and we're going to talk about George Carlin when we come back.
Whilst I illuminate the possibilities. Well, Alibaba had them 40 thieves. Sherazade had 1,000 tails. But master, you in luck, cause up your sleeves, you got a brand of magic never fails. You got some power in your corner now. Some heavy ammunition in your camp. You got some punch to dance. Your blue and house.
I love words. I thank you for hearing my words. I want to tell you something about words that I think is important. I love, as I say, they're my work, they're my play, they're my passion. Words are all we have, really. We have thoughts, but thoughts are fluid, you know. And then we assign a word to a thought, and we're stuck with that word for that thought. So be careful with words. I like to think, yeah, the same words, you know, that hurt can heal. It's a matter of how you pick them. There are some people that aren't into all the words. There are some people that would have you not use certain words. Yeah, there are 400,000 words in the English language, and there are 7 of them you can't say on television. What a ratio that is. 399,993 to 7. They must really be bad. They'd have to be outrageous to be separated from a group that large. All of you over here, you 7. Bad words. That's what they told us they were, remember? That's a bad word. No bad words. Bad thoughts. Bad intentions. And words.
Of course, that's George Carlin, one of the most famous routines or soliloquies in comedy ever done. George Carlin died 10 years ago on Sunday, June 22nd, 2008, of heart failure. He was 71 years old. So first of all, I have to do some thank yous right here. Jonathan McNichol, of course, is the person who produced this episode of our show. Betsy Kaplan's on the board because Wolfie has someplace else she needs to be. Jason Perez is our terrific intern, and the part of Bill Curry was played by Kevin Hart. We're now going to talk about George Carlin with James Sullivan, a journalist who covers popular and less popular culture, the author of 7 Dirty Words, The Life and Crimes of George Carlin. We have 2 comedians who regularly appear on our show, on the Nose. I think they've never met one another, but Sean Murray is the other one. You have, okay. Sean Murray's the other one, stand-up comedian, writer, and host of Fantasy Film Ball podcast. David Scoff is still with us. His biography of Robin Williams is Robin, but he's a cultural reporter for the New York Times. He knows about as much about comedy as it is possible to know, so this will be interesting. So, you know, we just heard this kind of classic thing, James Sullivan, and we've been talking Robin Williams. I mean, these 2 comedians, they almost couldn't be more different. Or is that yeah. not, or is that a myth? Am I wrong about that?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, so, you know, whereas obviously you've spent quite a bit of time talking about how volatile and, you know, sort of, you know, no filter Robin Williams was, George Carlin sort of set the guidelines for comedians who are much more studious than that. I mean, he sort of, you know, was, you know, always had note cards and, you know, was very well scripted. I mean, you know, that bit that you just played might have sounded a little bit off the cuff, but it certainly wasn't. I mean, I think from very early on in his career, he was very well organized and prepared. And it wasn't about shutting the filter off. Maybe it was in the creation process for him, but not in the delivery.
Right. If you go back to early, I'm old enough to remember the George Carlin who would come on the Merv Griffin show and he'd do a routine about a drill sergeant for the Indians when they were fighting the settlers. And in terms of shtick and bit and that kind of thing, it's a little bit more Robin Williams-like, except every beat in it, as you're suggesting, James Sullivan, every beat is nailed down in a very specific way.
Right. Well, that's sort of what, you know, Carlin's revelation was in the early 1970s, was that he was doing sort of old school comedy, you know, wacky characters and, you know, impressions and, you know, creating wacky characters like the Hippy Dippy Weatherman or whatever. But what he realized was that he wanted to hear himself in his own comedy and wanted to talk about what he found interesting, which is the bit that he played, you know, indicates was in most cases the language, our language, you know, as he said, it's all we got, so you might as well spend some time thinking about it, and he certainly did.
I mean, he did this remarkable thing, too, I was saying to Jonathan before the show, which is, you know, for quite a bit of his career, he was kind of part of the culture, and so he'd be on the Jimmy Dean show, kind of making mm-hmm. fun of hippies, you know,
right.
and like, he just walked through a door and walked back in, and he was part of the counterculture. Was it as seamless as it looked?
No, not necessarily. I mean, you know, he was, you know, there were questions about, bits that he was going to do on the Ed Sullivan Show in let's say 1969, when he was, you know, he did sort of a funny little poem about Muhammad Ali and Ali's fight to his conscientious to uphold his conscientious objector status and not wanting to go fight in Vietnam. And by that point Carlin had sort of grown the shaggier hair and a beard, but it really wasn't until 70 and 71 when he started really sort of distancing himself from the comedian that he had been and the guy who was sort of a presence on network television, whether it was Merv Griffin or sitcoms or those sort of summer replacement show, variety show type things that he did a lot of in the late 60s. You know, really it was in 1970, 71 when he just sort of decided. It was actually an episode in Las Vegas where he was opening for Diana Ross, he got in trouble for saying one of the seven words, one of the milder ones, and basically sort of decided that he was done with the, trying to appeal to everyone and trying to appeal to middle America by doing those TV shows and the Vegas dates, and that he was going to do something else entirely with his comedy.
So Sean Murray, if I'd had to guess, I wouldn't necessarily associate you and your tastes with George Carlin. So tell us what you're thinking about as we're talking about George Carlin.
I always loved Carlin, but I feel like as I grew older, I kind of started appreciating Carlin more than I actually liked his comedy. Like, I always felt like, growing up, I always heard of Carlin as, like, one of the three greatest, along with Cosby and Pryor. And, like, I used to laugh a lot harder at his stuff when I was younger. And then as I got older, I was like, it was kind of just like I recognized that Carlin was very smart and very clever. But, like, I very rarely find myself, like, laughing, like, uncontrollably at a Carlin joke these days.
Right. I find that I'm kind of fighting that off sometimes in, I think, a similar way to you, Sean. But then he'll kind of overwhelm me. I watched a clip today where he was talking about self-help books, and he said that that's a stupid name because if you could help yourself, you wouldn't need the book, you know? And he said they should be called help books. And, you know, I mean, after a while, like, I was sort of like you, Sean. I think I didn't want to laugh at that, and he kept hitting me with it until I had to laugh.
But he's definitely got some of those where it's like, I mean, he's funny. He's a great comedian. He's one of the greats. But it's just like I feel like a lot of Carlin stuff, which is like, I'm going to show you how smart I am, and there's also a few jokes.
Right. Okay, that's a really interesting point. And Dave Itzkoff, you're still with us. I react to that a little bit. I mean, there is a way in which Carlin, his mastery of language becomes kind of a comic, it becomes really his primary motif.
Yeah, I think that was definitely intrinsic to who he was, and previous guests have already talked about even though he had the sort of in a live setting he could certainly seem free and fluid, but that there was a lot of care and preparation that went into the routine, and that it was very carefully mapped out in advance. But yeah, I mean it became a kind of almost a meta commentary on itself that he just got so into the words and picking apart, breaking apart a word and what it meant, and the power of a word having multiple meanings, that if you could really take it apart into its components, that you could kind of defang it, or you could show how an element of language, how you can have mastery over it and take away the power that people use to lord it over you.
We, unfortunately, are going to have to stop right there. I want to talk a lot more about George Carlin, who I'm also realizing I don't know that much about as a person. So what we're all going to have to do is read James Sullivan's book, Seven Dirty Words, The Life and Crimes of George Carlin. Thanks to everybody who's been on this show. Sean Murray, stand-up comedian down in the New Haven area and host of Fantasy Film Ball podcast. Dave Itzkoff, his book is Robin. Carolyn Payne, comedian and everything else in studio with me. We're ending with a little bit of Carlin... almost kind of a little bit of George Carlin's version of jazz.
Lactose intolerant. I like rough sex. I like tough love. I use the F word in my email, and the software on my hard drive is hardcore, no soft porn. I bought a microwave at a mini mall. I bought a minivan at a megastore. I eat fast food in the slow lane. I'm toll-free, bite-sized, ready-to-wear, and I come in all sizes. A fully equipped, factory authorized, hospital tested, clinically proven, scientifically formulated medical miracle. I've been pre-washed, pre-cooked, pre-heated, pre-screened, pre-approved, pre-packaged, post-dated, freeze-dried, double-wrapped, vacuum-packed, and I have an unlimited broadband capacity. I'm a rude dude, but I'm the real deal. Lean and mean, cocked, locked, and ready to rock. Rough, tough, and hard to bluff. I take it slow, I go with the flow, I ride with the tide, I got glide in my stride. Driving and moving, sailing and spinning, jiving and grooving, wailing and winning. I don't snooze, so I don't lose. I keep the pedal to the metal and the rubber on the road. I party hardy, and lunchtime is crunch time. I'm hanging in, there ain't no doubt, and I'm hanging tough, over and out. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.